Okay, guys, so we're going to be reading chapters, I believe, 12 and 13 today of The Fault in Our Stars. So chapter 12. I woke up at 4 in the Dutch morning, ready for the day. All attempts to go back to sleep failed, so I lay there with the BiPAP pumping the air in and urging it out, enjoying the dragon sounds but wishing I could choose my breaths. I reread An Imperial Affliction until Mom woke up and rolled over towards me around 6. She nuzzled her head against my shoulder, which felt uncomfortable and vaguely Augustian. The hotel brought a breakfast to our room that, much to my delight, featured deli meat, among many other denials of American breakfast constructions. The dress I'd planned to wear to meet Peter Van Houten had been moved up in the rotation for the orangey dinner, so after I showered and got my hair to lie halfway flat, I spent like 30 minutes debating with Mom the various benefits and drawbacks of the available outfits before deciding to dress as much like Anna in An Imperial Affliction as possible. Chuck Taylors and dark jeans, like she always wore, and a light blue t-shirt. The shirt was a screen print of a famous surrealist artwork by René Magritte, in which he drew a pipe and then beneath it wrote in cursive, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe." This is not a pipe. "I just don't get that shirt," Mom said. "Peter Van Houten will like it, and he'll get it, trust me. There are like a million Magritte references in An Imperial Affliction." "But it is a pipe." "No, it's not," I said. "It's a drawing of a pipe, get it? All representations of a thing are inherently abstract. It's very clever." "How did you get so grown up that you understand things that confuse your ancient mother?" Mom asked. "It seems like just yesterday I was telling 7-year-old Hazel why the sky was blue. You thought I was a genius back then." "Why is the sky blue?" I asked. "'Cause," she answered. I laughed. As I got closer to 10, I grew more and more nervous. Nervous to see Augustus, nervous to meet Peter Van Houten, nervous that my outfit was not a good outfit, nervous that we wouldn't find the right house since all the houses in Amsterdam looked pretty similar. Nervous that we would get lost and never make it back to the Philosoof. Nervous, nervous, nervous. Mom kept trying to talk to me, but I couldn't really listen. I was about to ask her to go upstairs and make sure Augustus was up when he knocked. I opened the door. He looked down at the shirt and smiled. "Funny," he said. "Don't call my boobs funny," I answered. "Right here," Mom said behind us. But I made Augustus blush and put him enough off his game that I could finally bear to look up at him. "You sure you don't want to come?" I asked Mom. "I'm going to the Vondelpark today," she said. "Plus, I just don't get his book. No offense. Thank him for us, though, okay?" "Okay," I said, and I hugged Mom, and she kissed my head just above my ear. Peter Van Houten's white row house was just around the corner from the hotel, facing the park. Number 158. Augustus took me by one arm and grabbed the oxygen cart with the other, and we walked up the 3 steps to the lacquer blue-black front door. My heart pounded. One closed door away from the answers I'd dreamt of ever since I read that last unfinished page. Inside, I could hear a bass beat thumping loud enough to rattle the windowsills. I wondered whether Peter Van Houten had a kid who liked rap music. I grabbed the Lionhead's door knocker and I knocked tentatively. The beat continued. "Maybe he can't hear over the music?" Augustus asked. He grabbed the lion's head and knocked much louder. The music disappeared, replaced by shuffled footsteps. A deadbolt slid. Another. The door creaked open, and a pot-bellied man with thin hair, sagging jowls, and a week-old beard squinted into the sunlight. He wore baby blue man pajamas like guys in old movies. His face and belly were so round, and his arms so skinny, he looked like a dough ball with 4 sticks stuck onto it. "Mr. Van Houten?" Augustus asked, his voice squeaking a bit. The door slammed shut. Behind it, I heard a stammering, reedy voice shout, "Lita V!" Until then, I'd pronounced his assistant's name like Little Widge. We could hear everything through the door. "Are they here, Peter?" a woman asked. "They are. There are 2 adolescent apparitions outside the door." "Apparitions?" she asked with a pleasant Dutch lit. Van Houten answered in a rush. "Specters, ghouls, visitants, post-terrestrials, apparitions. How can someone pursuing a postgraduate degree in American literature display such abominable English language skills? Peter, those are not post-terrestrials. They're Augustus and Hazel, the young fans with whom you've been corresponding. They're what? They? I thought they were in America. Yes, but you invited them here. You will remember. Do you know why I left America? So that I would never again have to encounter Americans. But you are an American. Incurably so, it seems. But as to these Americans, you must tell them to leave at once. That there has been a terrible mistake, that the blessed Van Houten was making a rhetorical offer to meet, not an actual one, that such offers must be read symbolically. I thought I might throw up. I looked over at Augustus, who was staring intently at the door, and saw his shoulders slacken. I will not do this, Peter. You must meet them, you must. You need to see them. You need to see how your work matters. Did you knowingly deceive me to arrange this? A long silence ensued, and then finally the door opened again. He turned his head metronomically from Augustus to me, still squinting. Which of you is Augustus Waters? He asked. Augustus raised his hand tentatively. Van Houten nodded and said, Did you close the deal with that chick yet? Whereupon I encountered for the first and only time a truly speechless Augustus Waters. I, he started, I, Hazel, well, this boy appears to have some kind of developmental delay, Peter Van Houten said. Peter, she scolded. Well, Peter Van Houten said, extending his hand to me, it is at any rate a pleasure to meet such ontologically improbable creatures. I shook his swollen hand, and then he shook hands with Augustus. I was wondering what that meant. Regardless, I liked it. Augustus and I were together in the Improbable Creatures Club, us in duck-billed platypuses. Of course, I had hoped that Peter Van Houten would be sane, but the world is not a wish-granting factory. The important thing was the door was open, and I was crossing the threshold to learn what happened after the end of an imperial affliction. That was enough. We followed him inside, past a huge oak dining room table with only two chairs, into a creepily sterile living room. It looked like a museum, except there was no art on the empty white walls. Aside from one couch and one lounge chair, both a mix of steel and black leather, the room seemed empty. Then I noticed two large black garbage bags, full and twist-tied, behind the couch. Trash, I mumbled to Augustus soft enough that I thought no one else would hear. Fan mail, Van Houten answered as he sat down in the lounge chair. 18 years worth of it. Can't open it. Terrifying. Yours are the first that I have to which I have replied. And look where that got me. I frankly find the reality of readers wholly unappetizing. That explained why he'd never replied to my letters. He'd never read them. I wondered why he kept them at all, let alone in an otherwise empty formal living room. Van Houten kicked his feet up onto the ottoman and crossed his slippers. He motioned towards the couch. Augustus and I sat down next to each other, but not too next. Would you care for some breakfast? Asked his assistant. I started to say that we'd already eaten when Peter interrupted. It is far too early for breakfast. Well, they're from America, Peter, so it's past noon in their bodies. Then it's too late for breakfast, he said. However, it being afternoon in the body and whatnot, we should enjoy a cocktail. Do you drink scotch? He asked me. Do I? No, I'm fine, I said. Augustus Waters? Van Houten asked, nodding towards Gus. I'm good. Just me, then. Scotch and water, please. Peter turned his attention to Gus, asking, You know how we make a scotch and water in this home? No, sir, Gus said. We pour scotch into a glass, and then we call to mind thoughts of water, and then we mix the actual scotch with the abstracted idea of water. His assistant said, Perhaps a bit of breakfast first, Peter. He looked towards us and stage whispered, She thinks I have a drinking problem. And I think the sun has risen, his assistant responded. Nonetheless, she turned the bar in the living room, reached up for a bottle of scotch, and poured a glass half full. She carried it to him, Peter Van Houten took a sip, and then she sat up straight in his chair. He sat up straight in his chair. A drink this good deserves one's best posture, he said. I began conscious of my own posture and sat up a little on the couch. I rearranged my cannula. Dad always told me you can judge people by the way they treat waiters and assistants. By this measure, Peter Van Houten would possibly be the world's douchiest douche. "So you like my book," he said to Augustus after another sip. "Yeah," I said, speaking up on Augustus's behalf. "And yes, Augustus, he made meeting you his wish so that we could come here, so that you could tell us what happens after the end of an imperial affliction." Van Houten said nothing, just took a long pull on his drink. After a minute, Augustus said, "Your book is sort of the thing that brought us together." "But you aren't together," he observed without looking at me. "The thing that brought us nearly together," I said. Now he turned to me. "Did you dress like her on purpose?" "Anna," I said. He just kept staring at me. "Kind of," I said. He took a long drink and then grimaced. "I do not have a drinking problem," he announced, his voice needlessly loud. "I have a Churchillian relationship with alcohol. I can crack jokes and govern England and do whatever I want to do, except not drink." He glanced over at his assistant and nodded toward his glass. She took it and then walked back to the bar. "Just the idea of water," he instructed. "Yeah, got it," she said, the accent almost American. The second drink arrived. Van Houten's spine stiffened again out of respect. He kicked off his slippers. He had really ugly feet. He was rather ruining the whole business of authorial genius for me, but he had the answers. "Well, I said, first we want to thank you for dinner last night, and..." "We bought them dinner last night?" he asked his assistant. "Yes." "Ah, yes, well, believe me when I say that you do not have me to thank, but rather my assistant, who is exceptionally talented in the field of spending my money." "It was our pleasure," his assistant said. "Well, thanks. At any rate," Augustus said. I could hear annoyance in his voice. "So here I am," Van Houten said after a moment. "What are your questions?" He seems so intelligent in print," Van Houten said to his assistant, regarding Augustus. "Perhaps the cancer has established a beachhead in his brain." "Peter," his assistant said, truly horrified. And I was horrified too, but there was something pleasant about a guy so despicable he wouldn't treat us differently. "We do have some questions, actually," I said. "I talked about them in my email. I don't know if you remember." "I do not." "His memory is compromised." "If only my memory would compromise," Van Houten responded. "So, our questions," I repeated. "She uses the royal we," Peter said, so to no one particular. Another sip. I didn't know what scotch tasted like, but if it tasted anything like champagne, I couldn't imagine how he could drink so much, so quickly, so early in the morning. "Are you familiar with the tortoise paradox?" he asked me. "We have questions about what happens to characters at the end of the book, specifically Anna's..." "You wrongly assume that I need to hear your question in order to answer it. You are familiar with the philosopher Zeno?" I shook my head vaguely. "Alas, Zeno was a pre-Socratic philosopher who is said to have discovered 40 paradoxes within the worldview put forth by Parmenides. Surely you know Parmenides?" "Parmenides," he said, and I nodded that I knew them, although I did not. "Thank God," he said. "Zeno professionally specialized in revealing the inaccuracies and oversimplifications of them, which wasn't difficult, since they were spectacularly wrong everywhere and always. They are valuable in precisely the way that it's valuable to have an acquaintance who reliably picks the wrong horse every time you take him to the racetrack. But Zeno's most important..." "Wait, give me a sense of your familiarity with Swedish hip-hop." I could not tell if Van Houten was kidding. After a minute, Augustus answered for me. "Limited," he said. "Okay, but presumably you know Afi Ochs Filthy's seminal album, Flacken." "We do not," I said for the both of us. "Play Bomfalarara immediately," he asked his assistant. His assistant walked over to an MP3 player, spun the wheel a bit, and then hit a button. A rap song boomed from every direction, and it sounded like a fairly regular rap song, except the words were in Swedish. After it was over, Van Houten looked at us expectantly, with his eyes as wide as they could get. "Yeah?" he asked. "Yeah?" "I'm sorry, sir, but we don't speak Swedish." "Well, of course you don't. Neither do I. Who the hell speaks Swedish? The important thing is not whatever nonsense the voices are saying, but what the voices are feeling. surely you know that there are only two emotions, love and fear, and that Filthy navigates between them with the kind of facility that one simply does not find in hip-hop music outside of Sweden. Shall I play it for you again? Are you joking? Gus said. Pardon? Is this some kind of performance? He looked up at the assistant and asked, is it? I'm afraid not, she answered. He's not always... This is unusually... Oh, shut up. Otto said that if you had not encountered the numinous, if you had not experienced a non-rational encounter with the Mysterium Tremendium, then his work was not for you. And I say to you, young friends, that if you cannot hear Filthy's bravadic response to fear, then my work is not for you. I cannot emphasize this enough. It was a completely normal rap song, except in Swedish. I said, so about an imperial affliction, Anna's mom, when the book ends, is about to... Ben Houghton interrupted me, tapping his glass as he talked, and his assistant refilled it again. So Zena is most famous for his tortoise paradox. Let us imagine that you are in a race with the tortoise. The tortoise has a 10-yard head start. In the time it takes you to run that 10 yards, the tortoise has maybe moved 1 yard. And then in the time it takes you to make up that distance, the tortoise goes a bit farther, and so on forever. You're faster than the tortoise, but you can never catch him. You can only decrease his lead. Of course, you can just run past the tortoise without contemplating the mechanics involved, but the question of how you're able to do this turns out to be incredibly complicated, and no one really solved it until Cantor showed us that some infinities are bigger than other infinities. I said, I assume that answers your question, he said, confidently, then sipped generously from his glass. Not really, I said. We were wondering, after the end of an imperial affliction... I disavow everything in that putrid novel, Van Houten said, cutting me off. No, I said. Excuse me. No, that's not acceptable, I said. I understand that the story ends mid-narrative because Anna dies or becomes too sick to continue, but you said you would tell us what happens to everyone, and that's why we're here, and I need you to tell me. Van Houten sighed. After another drink, he said, very well, whose story do you seek? Anna's mom, the Dutch tulip man, Sisyphus, the hamster, I mean, just what happens to everyone? Van Houten closed his eyes and puffed his cheeks as he exhaled, and then looked up at the exposed wooden beams crisscrossing the ceiling. The hamster, he said after a while. The hamster gets adopted by Christine, who was one of Anna's pre-sickness friends. That made sense. Christine and Anna play with Sisyphus in a few scenes. He's adopted by Christine and lives for a couple years after the end of the novel, and dies peacefully in his hamster sleep. Now we are getting somewhere. Great, I said. Great. Okay. So the Dutch tulip man. Is he a con man? Do he and Anna's mom get married? Van Houten took a drink, and he was still staring at the glass beams. His glass was also almost empty again. I can't do it. I can't. I can't. He leveled his gaze to me. Nothing happens to the Dutch tulip man. He isn't a con man, or not a con man. He's God. He's an obvious and ambiguous metaphorical representation of God, and asking what becomes of him is the intellectual equivalent of asking what becomes of the disembodied eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg in Gatsby. Do he and Anna's mom get married? We are speaking of a novel, dear child, not some historical enterprise. Right, but surely you must have thought about what happens to them, I mean as characters. I mean, independent of their metaphorical meanings or whatever. They're fictions, he says, tapping his glass again. Nothing happens to them. You said you'd tell me, I insisted. I reminded myself to be assertive. I needed to keep his adult attention on my questions. Perhaps, but I was under the misguided impression that you were incapable of transatlantic travel. I was trying to provide you some comfort, I suppose, which I should know better than to attempt. But to be perfectly frank, this childish idea that the author of a novel has some special insight into the characters in the novel... It's ridiculous. That novel was composed of scratches on a page, dear. The characters inhabiting it have no life outside of those scratches. What happened to them? They all ceased to exist the moment the novel ended. No, I said. I pushed myself up off the couch. No, I understand that, but it's impossible to not imagine a future for them. You're the most qualified person to imagine that future. Something happened to Anna's mother. She either got married or she didn't. She either moved to Holland with the Dutch tulip man or she didn't. She either had more kids or didn't. I need to know what happens to her. Van Houten pursed his lips. I regret that I cannot indulge your childish whims, but I refuse to pity you in the manner to which you are well accustomed. I don't want your pity, I said. Like all sick children, he answered dispassionately, you say you don't want pity, but your very existence depends on it. Peter, his assistant said, but he continued as he reclined there, his words getting rounder in his drunken mouth. Sick children inevitably become arrested. You are fated to live out your days as the child you were when you were diagnosed, the child who believes there is life after a novel ends. And we, as adults, we pity this, so we pay for your treatments, for your oxygen machines. We give you food and water, though you are unlikely to live long enough. Peter! You are a side effect, Van Houten continued, of an evolutionary process that cares little for individual lives. You are a failed experiment in mutation. I resign, his assistant shouted. There were tears in her eyes, but I wasn't angry. He was looking for the most hurtful way to tell the truth, but of course I already knew the truth. I'd had years of staring at ceilings from my bedroom to the ICU, and so I had long ago found the most hurtful ways to imagine my own illness. I stepped towards him. Listen, douche pants, I said, you're not going to tell me anything about disease that I don't already know. I need one thing and only one thing from you before I walk out of your life forever. What happens to Anna's mother? He raised his flabby chins vaguely towards me and shrugged his shoulders. I can tell you no more of what happens to her than I could tell you what becomes of Prof's narrator, or Holden Caulfield's sister, or Huckleberry Finn after he lights out for the territories. Bullshit. That's bullshit. Just tell me. Make something up. No, and I'll think you do not curse in my home. It isn't becoming of a lady. I still wasn't angry, exactly, but I was very focused on getting things that I had been promised. Something inside me welled up, and I reached down and smacked the swollen hand that held the glass out of scotch. The glass of scotch. What remained of the scotch splashed across the vast expanse of his face, the glass bouncing off his nose and then spinning balletically throughout the air, landing with a shattering crash on the ancient hardwood floors. Van Houten said calmly, I'll have a martini if you please, just a whisper of her mouth. I have resigned, his assistant said after a second. Don't be ridiculous. I didn't know what to do. Being nice hadn't worked, I mean, being mean hadn't worked. I needed an answer. I'd come all this way, hijacked Augustus's wish. I needed to know. Have you ever stopped to wonder, he said, why you care so much about your silly questions? You promised, I shouted, hearing Isaac's impotent wailing echoing from the night of the broken trophies. Van Houten didn't reply. I was standing over him, waiting for him to say something to me when I felt Augustus's hand on my arm. He pulled me away towards the door and I followed him. You'll have to forgive my former assistant, he said. Dutch is not so much a language as an ailment of the throat. Augustus finally pulled me out of the room and threw the door to the late spring morning and falling confetti of the elms. For me, there was no such thing as a quick getaway, but we made our way down the stairs, Augustus holding my cart, and then started to walk back towards the hotel in a bumpy sidewalk of interwoven rectangular bricks. For the first time since the swing set, I started crying. Hey, he said, touching my waist. Hey, it's okay. I nodded and wiped my face with the back of my hand. He sucks, I nodded again. I'll write you an epilogue, Gus said. That made me cry harder. I will, he said, I will. Better than any shit that drunk could ever write. His brain is Swiss cheese. He doesn't even remember writing the book. I can write 10 times the story that guy can. There will be blood and guts and sacrifice. An imperial affliction meets the price of dawn. You'll love it. I kept nodding, faking a smile, and then he hugged me, his strong arms pulling me into his chest. And I sogged up his polo shirt a little, but then recovered enough to speak. I spent your wish on that douche face, I said. Hazel Grace, no. I will grant you that you did not spend my one and only wish. That you did spend my one and only wish, but you did not spend it on him. You spent it on us. Behind him, I heard the plonk plonk of high heels running. I turned around. It was Van Houten's assistant, her eyeliner running down her cheeks, duly horrified, chasing us up the sidewalk. Perhaps we should go to Anne Frank, the Anne Frank house, she said. I'm not going anywhere with that monster, Augustus said. He is not invited, she said. Augustus kept holding me protective, his hand on the side of my face. I don't think, he started, but I cut him off. We should go. I still wanted answers from Van Houten, but that wasn't all I wanted. I only had 2 days left in Amsterdam with Augustus, and I wouldn't let a sad old man ruin them. Chapter 13. The next morning, our last full day in Amsterdam, Mom and Augustus and I walked the half block from the hotel to the park, where we found a cafe in the shadow of the Dutch National Film Museum. Over lattes, which the waiter explained to us, the Dutch called wrong coffee because it had more milk than coffee. We sat in the lacy shade of a huge chestnut tree and recounted for Mom our encounter of the great Peter Van Houten. We made the story funny. You have a choice in this world, I believe, about how to tell sad stories, and we made the funny choice. Augustus, slumped in the cafe chair, pretended to be the tied-tongued, word-slurring Van Houten who could not so much as push himself up out of his chair. I stood up to play a full-of-me bluster and mock, and shouted, "Get up, you fat, ugly old man!" "Did you just call him ugly?" Augustus asked. "Just go with it," I said. "I'm not ugly. You're the ugly one, nose-tube girl." "You're a coward," I rumbled, and Augustus broke character to laugh, and I sat down. We told Mom about the Anne Frank house. "Did you go back to Van Houten afterward?" Mom asked. Augustus didn't even give me time to blush. "No, we just hung out at a cafe." Hazel amused me with some Venn diagram humor. He glanced at me. God, he was sexy. "Sounds lovely," she said. "Listen, I'm going to go for a walk. Give the two of you time to talk," she said at Gus, an edge in it. "But maybe later we can go for a tour on a canal boat." Okay, I said. Mom left a 5-euro note under her saucer and then kissed me on top of the head, whispering, "I love, love, love you," which was two more loves than usual. Gus motioned down the shadows of the branches, intersecting and coming apart on the concrete. "Beautiful, huh?" "Yeah," I said. "Such a good metaphor," he mumbled. "Is it now?" I asked. "The negative image of things blown together and then blown apart," he said. Before us, hundreds of people passed, jogging and bike riding and rollerblading. Amsterdam was a city designed for movement and activity, a city that would rather not travel by car, and so inevitably I felt excluded from it. But God, was it beautiful. The creek carving a path around the huge tree, a heron standing still in the water's edge, searching for a breakfast amid the millions of elm petals floating in the water. But Augustus didn't notice. He was too busy watching the shadows move. Finally, he said, "I could look at this all day, but we should go to the hotel." "Do we have time?" I asked. He smiled sadly. "If only," he said. "What's wrong?" I asked. He nodded back in the direction of the hotel. We walked in silence, Augustus a half step in front of me. I was too scared to ask if I had a reason to be scared. There's this thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It looks like this. Self-actualizing needs, esteem needs, social needs, security, and physiologically. At the bottom, there's food, water, shelter, air, and warmth. At the top, it's self-aware personal growth. And once your needs for food and water are fulfilled, you move up to the next set of needs, security, and the next. But the important thing is that, according to Maslow, until your physiological needs are satisfied, you can't even worry about security or social needs, let alone self-actualization, which is when you start to, like, make art and think about mortality and morality and quantum physics and stuff. According to Maslow, I was stuck on the second level of the pyramid, unable to secure in my health, and therefore unable to reach for love and respect and art and whatever else, which is, of course, utter horseshit. The urge to make art or contemplate philosophy does not go away when you're sick. Those urges just become transfigured by illness. His pyramid seemed to imply that I was less human than other people, and most people seemed to agree with him, but not Augustus. I always thought he could love me because he'd once been sick. But only now did it occur to me that maybe he still was. We arrived in my room. I sat down on the bed expecting him to join me, but he hunkered down in the dusty paisley chair. That chair, how old was it? 50 years? I felt the ball in the base of my throat hardening as I watched him pull a cigarette from the pack and stick it between his lips. He leaned back and sighed. Just before you went into the ICU, I started to feel this ache in my hip. No, I said. Panic rolled in, pulled me under. He nodded, so I went in for a PET scan. He nodded. He yanked the cigarette out of his mouth and clenched his teeth. Much of my life had been devoted to trying not to cry in front of people who loved me, so I knew what he was doing. You always clench your teeth. You look up. You tell yourself that if they see you cry, it will hurt them, and you will be nothing but a sadness in their lives. And you must not become a mere sadness, so you will not cry. And you say all of this to yourself while looking up at the ceiling, and then you swallow even though your throat does not want to close, and you look at the person who loves you, and you smile. He flashed his crooked smile and then said, I lit up like a Christmas tree, Hazel Grace. The lining of my chest, my left hip, my liver, everywhere. Everywhere. That word hung in the air a while. We both knew what it meant. He was stroking my hair. I'm so sorry, I said. I'm sorry I didn't tell you, he said, his voice calm. Your mom must know, the way she looked at me. My mom must have told her something. I should have told you. It was stupid. Selfish. I knew why he hadn't said anything, of course. The same reason I hadn't wanted him to see me in the ICU. I couldn't be mad at him for even a moment, and only now that I loved a grenade did I understand the foolishness of trying to save others from my own impending fragmentation. I couldn't unlove Augustus Waters, and I didn't want to. It's not fair, I said. It's just so unfair. The world, he said, it's not a wish-granting factory. And then he broke down, just for one moment, his sob roaring impotent like a clap of thunder, unaccompanied by lightning, the terrible ferocity that amateurs in the field of suffering might mistake for weakness. Then he pulled me to him, and his face inches from mine, resolved. I'll fight it. I'll fight it for you. Don't you worry about me, Hazel Grace. I'm okay. I'll find a way to hang around and annoy you for a long time. I was crying, but even then he was strong, holding me so tight that I could see his muscles of his arms wrapped around me as he said, I'm sorry, you'll be okay. It'll be okay, I promise. And he smiled his crooked smile. He kissed my forehead and then I felt his powerful chest deflate just a little. I guess I had a hamartia after all. After a while, I pulled him over to the bed and we laid there as he told me they'd started palliative chemo, but he gave it up to go to Amsterdam, even though his parents were furious. They'd tried to stop him right until that morning when I heard him screaming that his body belonged to him. We could have rescheduled, I said. No, we couldn't have, he answered. Anyways, it wasn't working. I could just tell it wasn't working, you know? I nodded. It's just bullshit, the whole thing, I said. They'll try something else when I get home. They've always got a new idea. Yeah, I said, having the experimental pincushion myself. I kind of conned you into believing you were falling in love with a healthy person, he said. I shrugged. I would have done the same to you. No, you wouldn't have, but we can't all be as awesome as you. He kissed me and then grimaced. Does it hurt? I asked. No, just... He stared at the ceiling for a long time before saying, I like this world. I like drinking champagne. I like not smoking. I like the sound of Dutch people speaking Dutch. And now, I don't even get a battle. I don't get a fight. You get to battle cancer, I said. That's your battle, and you'll keep fighting. I told him. I hated it when people tried to build me up to prepare for battle, but I did it to him anyways. You'll live your best life today. This is your war now. I despised myself for the cheesy sentiment, but what else did I have? Some war, he said dismissively. What am I at war with, my cancer? And what is my cancer? My cancer is me. The tumors are me. They're part of me as surely as my brain and my heart are part of me. It's a civil war, Hazel Grace, with a predetermined winner. Gus, I said. I couldn't say anything else. He was too smart for the kinds of solace I could offer. Okay, he said, but it wasn't. After a moment, he said, if you want to go to the museum, which I really wanted to, but who are we kidding? Neither of us can walk through a museum. But anyways, I looked at the collection online before we left. If you were to go, and hopefully someday you will, you would see a lot of paintings of dead people. You'd see Jesus on the cross. You'd see a dude getting stabbed in the neck. You'd see people dying at sea and in battle, and a parade of martyrs. But not one single cancer kid. Nobody biting it from the plague or smallpox or yellow fever or whatever, because there's no glory in illness. There is no meaning to it. There is no honor in dying of. Maslow, I present to you Augustus Waters, whose existential curiosity dwarfed that of his well-fed, well-loved, healthy brethren. While the mass of men went on leading thoroughly unexamined lives of monstrous consumption, Augustus Waters examined the collection of the museum from afar. What? He asked after a while. Nothing. I couldn't finish the sentence. I didn't know how to. I'm just very fond of you. He smiled with half his mouth, his nose inches from mine. The feeling is mutual. I don't suppose you can forget about it and treat me like I'm not dying? I don't think you're dying, I said. I think you've just got a touch of cancer. He smiled. Gallows humor. I'm on a roller coaster that only goes up, he said. And it is my privilege and my responsibility to ride all the way up with you, I said. Would it be absolutely ludicrous to try to make out? There is no try, I said. There is only do. Sorry, guys, I got kind of emotional. I tried to hold it together for the reading, but, so yeah, those are the two chapters. This was kind of longer, and also I'm sorry this is uploaded late. I've had so much going on with school, and also trying to upload regularly on YouTube, but I'm going to try to stick with the Sunday night uploads from here on out. So thank you guys so much for being here and supporting me. And I hope if you guys are listening to this to fall asleep, I hope you guys have really sweet dreams. And yeah, thank you guys. Bye.